Oyez, oyez, oyez.
The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. The orders of the court are posted outside and available for your inspection. Three matters will be submitted by oral argument to the court this morning. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. Transamerica Natural Gas Corporation versus the Honorable William R. Powell, an original mandamus proceeding. National Union Fire Insurance Company versus Jose Merriman from Zapata County. And Coalition of Cities for Affordable Utility Rights and Others versus the Public Utility Commission of Texas and Others from Travis County. Between each of these matters, the court will take a brief recess, but we will conclude all three oral arguments before our lunch break. Counsel in the second and third causes are not required to remain in the courtroom while earlier matters are being argued, but please remain on standby so that we may proceed to your matter without delay. Counsel in all causes are advised that these arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. Should you desire to listen to the tapes of these arguments, you may make application with our clerk. Court is now ready to hear oral argument from the relator in Transamerica Natural Gas Corporation versus the Honorable William R. Powell. Each side has been allocated 20 minutes for oral argument with 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Can please report, Mr. W. James Conger and Mr. Bill Jones will present arguments from the relator. Mr. Conger will argue.
May it please the court, my newly found partner, Joe Reynolds, is unable to be here today. He's been heavily sedated for some surgery he's going to have. And so Bill Jones, who's been familiar with the case from the very outset, will make the closing argument. I'll try to present the opening argument. As we view it from the relator's standpoint, the only true issue or real issue is whether or not a Transamerican had an adequate remedy at law so that this mandamus effort is premature. This is not to say that the respondent or the real party in interest, has not had a lot of things to say about what has happened before we got here. I hope to take most of my time at least trying to isolate the true issue. Judge Powell, the district judge, sustained a motion that's in the documents that you have before you to strike all of the relator's pleadings, both offensively and defensively, and an alternative prayer was included in that motion, and that was, if you don't do this, give us a setting that on May 23rd. So that we can have that deposition of this president of relator at that time. The judge, based upon their amended motion for sanctions, did not afford any relief about resetting the deposition. He just struck all pleadings based on the non-appearance of the president for his deposition that they noticed for May 2nd of last year. But this matter has first got to be put in its context. The case was set for July of last year for trial on the merits. And the court's cutoff order, that which I guess you see now all the time, and because local rules authorize it, and so has this court. The cutoff order precluded any discovery after April the 3rd, except by agreement of counsel. Now, the rules themselves 166C in particular provide that even after a cutoff order, that the parties may by agreement enter into order with respect to depositions, that and those agreements can become enforceable. What 166C says in that regard is just an extrapolation or a clarification of Rule 11 itself relating to agreements between counsel, which itself says if there are written agreements and they're filed among the papers in the cause, that they would be enforceable, Rule 11, but it's broader than 166C dealing with agreements regarding deposition. But 166C requires that the agreement on the non-appearance of the party be stated into the record and the transcript. Now at that point, if the court please, certainly respondents were unwilling to make that statement because the record stands unchallenged that there never was any agreement between the parties to have Mr. Shepherd, the deponent, present on May 2nd, 1989. There just wasn't any enforceable agreement, and the correspondent between the parties recognizes that.
Was there an agreement to take his deposition sometime after the trial?
What it was, Your Honor, when he couldn't appear, or when the relator said that he couldn't appear, that until the letter, Exhibit A in these last materials that we followed, from the in-house counsel that was then representing Transamerica, it just said, we will have him available as of April 10th, please let us know when it will be an agreeable date with you. Now, there isn't any ambiguity or equivocation about that, Justice Heck. If you look at their letter responding to that we recognize we've not made an agreement and we're just tired of messing around with you.
They say they then wrote to you and requested approximately April the 17th, and yet there was no response back as to a convenient date, so therefore they...
I think that's true, Your Honor. There was no response back setting in or the agreement, and they said, well, I think we tried to agree on an earlier time, and they couldn't agree, but regardless of those trading back and forth, their letter of April 19th, which says we're going to go ahead and do it now by notice, clearly says in it that we have never been able to reach an agreeable date.
One of the reasons I see in the record is that on May 2nd, he allegedly was scheduled for another deposition.
That's correct.
On page 12 of their, this is called their limited reply, they point out that as of May 2nd, although he was scheduled for another deposition, that deposition was not scheduled until after you had received their letter requesting May 2nd.
That is what their allegations have said. That same litigation up in Northeast Texas had also been the basis for a postponement of a prior setting on April 16th. And they also had an effort to take his deposition on the 10th of April. But Justice Cook, let me make it clear. We don't stand before you saying that our clients, through their then counsel, could not have done more to eliminate the in-house mix-ups. And I'm not just here preaching good news for the outhouse lawyers instead of the in-house lawyers, but I'll just say to you that where we are and where we say we are is that the noticed deposition set for a month after the cutoff was not one upon which a trial court can enter an order granting these sanctions that he did. And let me make that as clear as I can. Shortly before the cutoff date expired or was reached, The relator sought to take a number of depositions itself, or noticed them, but would have necessarily fallen after April 3rd, the cutoff date. They filed a motion, but based on the cutoff date, to prevent those depositions and represented in it, one, that all discovery had been complete, and secondly, in an affidavit, went even further and said, we have talked to all the other lawyers on our side, and they're ready to go. The effect of which was to cause the judge to cut off any further discovery by the relator. Later, when a further attempt was made, they again moved to rely on the cutoff order. So we don't have any question about the sanctity and the in-place position of the cutoff order.
May I ask you a question? What do you feel is the purpose of sanctions?
The purpose of sanctions is obviously to make several things. Set examples for the bar to understand, to follow.
The deterrence theory?
And it is also to set, to permit the parties to try to reach understandings, agreements, to work these things out without troubling the courts. And I can tell you, Justice Cook, on my own knowledge of working with the rules for 25 years up here, that those have been the most difficult areas that we have ever had. Now, the question is, the discovery and how discovery should work, both for experts, all the problem and experts, and discovery materials. Now, as Jim Sales prophesied, whenever the court decided Barker and Dunham and Allen versus Humphrey and said discovery matters can be made the subject of mandamus actions, if you recall, he predicted there would be a fiasco that we just have. While I don't agree with everything Jim Sales says, as the court well knows, it's well nigh approached that. I personally retired as of January last year of handling any case in which I was responsible for discovery. I think it's been a nice thing since that time. But without being humorous about the seriousness of the case either, that where we come down is you can't impose the ultimate sanctions where there has been no order entered, where they didn't seek to extend the time themselves for this deposition, and just say, okay, you can set it arbitrarily after the cutoff period, and then the court can impose the sanction. Let me add this about that to the court. Some conversation and statements made in their response that there was a history of discovery abuse by Transamerica, and I'm sure you've read it and you've seen that. When you look at the record, and unfortunately in the detail you have to, there wasn't any order, discovery abuse, or sanction, or motion. I think it is critically important for our position to make it clear that his order was not based on discovery abuse. Their motion for sanctions was not based on discovery abuse. The docket entry he made was based purely on the non-appearance on May 2nd, a time at which there wasn't any agreement and the cutoff period had not only expired, they didn't want to move to open it because they'd been trying to keep it closed for 30 days. And we're not necessarily talking about justice as such on what discovery is and isn't. For example, they cite and rely on the decision of the Dallas court when Justice Heck was there in the Plorin case, in which these folks claimed that a construction man, a contractor on foundations, had, under DTPA, hadn't done his job. And so early on, the lawyer for the contractor contacted the plaintiff's lawyer, and he agreed with him in writing that, in writing, that he would let them come and have their experts examine the foundation. Whatever the reasons, the plaintiffs may not wanted to have had it looked at by somebody else. They nonetheless, in violation of the written agreement, got some other guy out there and fixed the foundation up. When they got there, he said, hey, we already done this. And Justice Heck, the majority of the Dallas court, held that the rules don't require an order. And they don't require that there be a history of discovery abuse. When you violate an agreement that you have solemnly made in such a manner that that did permit the enforcement and use of sanctions. And we don't have a quarrel with the Plorin case because there was an agreement to do the very thing that they were cut off from doing. It is true, and I don't have much more time, and y'all, the court's probably glad about that. But it is true that they had tried to get his deposition, Mr. Shepherd's deposition.
Shouldn't there be some line other than just an agreement or not? I mean, in the Plorin case, the whole underlying basis of the cause of action, that the information was destroyed. The other side was prevented permanently from getting a fair trial, where a deposition is, you know.
Mr. Chief, anyway.
Don't we have to draw some line other than just a fight over whether there was agreement or non-agreement?
My suggestion to the court is that absent some type of agreement before you take away all the defenses, all the offenses. That's, I think you now know the bankruptcy courts have held it was defective pipe. So you talk about harm. That goes right to the heart of our case. But is if you permit or authorize, and once again, I want to make it clear, I don't say y'all can't do what you think ought to be done. But if you permit it to be done on some theory of discovery abuse, or we tried two times before and the third time ought to be out, with there being no agreement and with the cutoff orders being what they are, then it very much seems to me that you talk about a flood.
But is an agreement alone sufficient, in your opinion? I mean, if you had an ironclad agreement, take somebody's deposition, sign in blood for May the 2nd, and he didn't show up, would that be, would a trial court be within its discretion in dismissing the case, or would it take more?
Your Honor, historically, your records will show that 166C got on our books and our rules. Just what you posed, that an agreement can be enforced if the agreement, if there is an agreement, and if it is reduced in the transcript. Now, it seems to me the question that's rhetorically posed is, should we go beyond that and just say that the judge ought to have so much inherent power that with or without an agreement, with or without an extension of a cutoff...
I'm really going the other way. Is an agreement alone sufficient, or can the judge abuse his discretion in dismissing an action, even if there has been an agreement?
In my opinion, Your Honor, if there is an agreement that satisfies either Rule 11 or 166C, that then the court can enforce it, just as in Florida. I mean, I don't...
But with dismissal?
Beg your pardon?
But with dismissal. Can he enforce it with dismissal?
I'm saying if he breaches the agreement, then you're just in the same shape, Justice Heck. It seems to me as if you had a notice that was properly taken before the cutoff and the guy on the show, and you don't, and the judge has his discretion. I hope I'm not arguing that or made that position.
Counsel, at one time in a foreign country, stealing a chicken was a death penalty offense. And what I think we're trying to find out is dismissal is the ultimate punishment.
That's right. And that's what we think.
And should that, in other words, if a person breaks his word, should that entitle the other side to the ultimate punishment?
Well, we're talking about the absolutes, Justice Cook. I'm talking about then the trial judge has discretion to act on the agreement. There may be reasons and explanations which he would not strike the pleading.
Should the punishment fit the crime?
Well, that's, I mean, that's the good anonym for it. I mean, that's, I'm just, I know I'm not apparently making it as clear as I think, but if the court takes a new trip out on uncharted waters where there aren't any agreements, and they don't want to move, they didn't want to move, for obvious reasons, when you read their motions to cut off, I mean to hold on to the cutoff order, they didn't want to move to open it up for any purpose. And yet all they want to do is to set it at a time after the cutoff order, and now tell the court that you have power to uphold that order. And believe me, and I'll conclude.
Let me ask you a question before you sit down. Was there a hearing, a show-cause hearing of any kind set by the court before you engaged in the striking of proceedings and all, or on the 12th?
Justice Spears, let me say, we have affidavits that we didn't get any kind of constitutional due process hearing at all. Period.
On the motion of the other side.
Well, when we came over there to argue, so bam, I'll take them under advisement. But they rely on some cases that say, as between affiants who were there and make that statement, we didn't get any kind of a hearing, that say that as between the trial court's recitations in his order and affiants who were present, you have to give precedence over the recitations.
What is the reason for mandamus rather than appeal here because of the number of
other actions? My time's expired. Right. Hopefully we've covered that, because when in the case of Jampo versus Touche, the court said we are not going to go and back to adopt the presumed harm rule. The party affected by that ruling must be able to demonstrate harm, not only in that case, but subsequently in other decisions. You've held, if A, it appears to be a nullity, and B, that you'd be going through a useless exercise to try the case on damages.
I mean, if this were a final judgment, everything had been struck except the trial on damages, and there were no other cross action pending. Would this be an appropriate case for mandamus, or is it appropriate for mandamus because there are numerous cross actions still pending? And
Judge, our position is not only Jampo and going back to Allen versus Humphreys in those cases, that there's no way we could, during the trial of the damage suit, make a record that would be viable for y'all to look at and see here. And that's exactly what you said in Jampo and in subsequent cases, which I think we've collected them for you. I mean, how do you do it? You go back and say,
you have a record either.
They say, Judge Powell, well, do we have a record that you can find harm? What we've got is a bunch of depositions taken by the other side, and usually you hold your fire there, and if anybody will stipulate that we don't need to prove harm beyond this, then that's fine. You know, if we can say it up the record, it doesn't make any difference, and go waste the time to try a damage suit on it. But that's not the answer to it. If the cases they rely on, those street cases, poor old Sam Walton, he got busted up for, $1 million a day, finally, up there in Fort Worth, for not appearing for his deposition. Those are cases in which that record that was made at the time those things happened could carry their own on appeal. But I honestly don't see, Mr. Chief Justice, how you can say this record, unless the court is willing to go to presumed harm, and you condemn that as a basis for adequate remedy and appeal. It isn't equally efficient, as the rules say ever since Fulton v. Fitch. You said those things, that it's got to be available, adequate, and be a satisfactory replacement for the mandamus hearing. If you now say, okay, the appeal could be heard later when the case comes up on the merits.
Let me ask you a question. As I understand what you told us earlier, there was no motion for sanctions. The trial judge just did it on his own.
No, sir. They moved for sanctions, Justice Ray, on the grounds of his non-appearance. And that gets us back, we think, to square one. Did they have a basis? But I...
Well, they moved for sanctions, and they set it for a hearing, and you went to the hearing, and the judge simply said, I'll take it under advisement.
And they now defend that on the grounds of recitations in his order.
Said that there, it was done after a hearing.
After a hearing.
And you have affidavits that say that the hearing consisted of, I'll take it under advisement.
Yes, we do, and that's okay. But thank you for extending the time. And
any other
questions? Any other questions? Thank you very much.
The court is ready to hear argument from the response.
Okay, please, the court, Mr. Jonathan Cox, will present argument to the response.
May it please the court, my name is Jonathan Cox. I'd like to introduce you to Ann Robertson from Winston McGuire, Sechrist and Minnick, and Mr. Don Hallbaker, who wrote the brief and did the research and have been involved in this case from the beginning. You'll note that on the information that's been submitted to the court, there's also an attorney, Michael Feehan. He was going to be here. He's been involved in this case with Mr. Hallbaker and with myself from the beginning, which was really in January of 87, continuously throughout. I think we're the only three lawyers who have been involved continuously in this case, as some of the lawyers for Transamerica have been in and out of the case, depending upon the company's decision. Mr. Feehan couldn't be here today. His little boy, who's two weeks old, has got a medical problem, required him to have emergency treatment at the hospital. I called him last night, talked to him, boy, the boy's going to be fine, but he certainly gave the parents a scare. Toma Steel Supply is a Colorado company that came down and did business in Texas. It's actually owned by Tom and Marcy Rollo, and that's where the name Toma comes from. It comes from the contraction, the abbreviation of the first two initials of each of their names. Mr. Rollo attempted to be here today. He's the father of five children. His wife was called out of town last night, and he was unable to be here, so he's here in spirit, although he isn't here personally. Based upon the nature of this case and what's going on since it was filed in April of 87, May of 87 until the present time, I'd like to point out to the court that neither Mr. Kronzer nor Mr. Reynolds, who unfortunately couldn't be here today, have been involved in this case except in the appellate area. Similarly, the able lawyers from Waddell Sapp, who are seated here, were initially involved but essentially had no role in this case during the period of time in which the unfortunate circumstances regarding to discovery took place, in the period really from May or June of 1987 until June of 1989. Mr. Neighbors, Mr. Jones and others from the Waddell Sapp firm became re-involved and took an active role. As a result of that, this case has taken the posture it has now, and the record is before you. Transamerica, I'm sure as you all know, is a large company, been in Chapter 11. I think what this case is all about, and I intend to confine my remarks to what's before you, what we consider to be the record, as opposed to those matters which have been introduced, which are really outside the record, but I'm delighted to answer any questions that you have with respect to the status of any other matters outside of the scope of this case.
Was there a hearing?
There was a hearing in the sense that it would comply with the local rule, which was it was done on submission, and Transamerica appeared and vigorously argued by filing responsive motions on the motions for sanction, and the motion for sanction was filed, I believe, on May 8th, and on May 10th, I believe, there was a supplement to the motion that was filed. And Transamerica, and I think this is an important point, and I wanted to address it as we went along, I'm glad you brought it up, Justice Cook, but Transamerica, this is the fifth bite at the apple on this. There was the motion for sanctions, motion for reconsideration, motion for leave to file or to refile pleadings or reinstate the pleadings, 14th Court of Appeals, per curiam opinion that essentially relied on 2nd versus Street, I think is the decision there, which essentially said this case is not appropriate, mandamus is not appropriate. I believe that's what the per curiam says. And, of course, this is the fifth shot at it. So if there is an issue, an underlying issue somewhere or a concern, has Transamerica had its opportunity to generate affidavits, get due process, have a fair shot, be heard, put on by affidavit any evidence, explain their circumstances, they've had four or five attempts at this.
Well, like the first time up, did the hearing consist of, I'll take it under advisement?
No, I believe what happened was it was done under the local rules of the Harris County District Court that affect Judge Powell's division on submission, which was in lieu of a hearing, and I believe they responded.
Did either party request an oral hearing? And under the local rules, either party can request an oral hearing, and the judge can have discretion to grant or deny that.
Well, I don't believe, I was present in court when this took place, and I, in some of these hearings that took place, and I don't believe that there was an oral hearing requested, but I will tell you that I am uncertain of that, and if that becomes an issue, would ask you for a period of time to be able to certify to you whether that fact took place.
Would you do that?
Yes.
And then you said,
it ought to be clear, the hearing has to be requested in writing, so it ought to be clear.
And then there was a motion for reconsideration. Was the second
yes, there was a motion for reconsideration that was filed of the sanction order.
Was there oral argument at that hearing?
I don't think there was oral argument at that hearing.
That was just the paper requested it be reconsidered and
right.
Denied.
I believe that's the case.
So the first time they were doing any oral argument, you think, was at the Court of Appeals after the damage had been done?
No, there was no argument at the Court of Appeals. I believe that that writ was denied the same day it was submitted.
Well, today, then.
This might be it. No, actually, there were some. No, there wasn't. There was a hearing that took place in court. I remember because there were 25 or 30 lawyers present, and that was the first time I think that Mr. Neighbors had had an opportunity to become involved in this case again. And I believe he made certain requests there, and I believe that the judge ruled right in open court on a couple of the second or third motions that were filed, either the motion for reconsideration or the motion to reinstate the pleading. Additional lawyers were being added as we got closer to trial. I believe that's when Don Henderson got added as a lawyer as well. I don't believe that there was a... I believe this was done on submission, and I do not believe that there was a request for oral argument, but we will certify that to you within whatever period of time you say.
By next Monday.
I'm sorry, did I hear you?
Yes.
All right. By next Monday.
Did
really?
Did you cover both the main hearing and the motion for reconsideration?
Yes. How about if we'll cover both the request for oral hearing, the hearing on the motion, if there was a hearing on the motion for reconsideration, and motion to reinstate. Okay. And there was no oral argument on the first mandamus.
What Justice Sargent asked you, was there a request for it?
Yes, I understood that.
On the munition.
Right. Okay.
Now, can you respond to the argument that the sanction that was imposed here was not because of the discovery of the use. It was simply because of the non-appearance of the witness. And there was no order that he appeared. And that the ultimate sanction should not be under these circumstances of the opponent.
My response to that is that it is inappropriate and misleading to assume that a course of conduct that takes place between May of 1987 and culminates in May of 1989 is to be disregarded, and you're to look at it as though you can freeze one frame in one event and assume that tells you the whole story. It would be like watching a baseball game in the third inning and predicting what the outcome would be. To assume that a trial, and this is actually really the message, and I look at this as though, although the rights of my client are going to be affected by whatever your decision is going to be, and although, I mean, this is really all about trench warfare, what goes on in the trenches down there. And it's all about management, how you manage, how the Supreme Court manages, how we manage the conduct of lawyers and litigation, and what's going to take place down there in the trial courts, and whether we're going to substitute the appellate court's judgment for the discretion of what the trial judge does down there, and whether we're going to continue to assume the trial judges are aware of what their dockets are, that they've got responsibilities to manage what's going on, and that whether the appellate court and the Supreme Court is going to be in the second-guessing business. Whether the test is really going to be perfection, or whether the test is going to remain, as you have announced over and over again, that we're talking about discretion. We're not talking about errors, a mere error in judgment with respect to something that takes place in the trial court.
If there were nothing more than missing a deposition, would the dismissal of the action, striking of the pleadings, be too severe for that simple limited discovery offense?
It may be if that's considered to be the ultimate sanction and if that's the policy that the Supreme Court now wants to announce. I mean, what's happened is under Rule 215, what happens is we really have a hierarchy of sanctions, and it goes down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Subparagraph 5 is the provision that allows you to enter a default judgment, allows you to strike certain kinds of pleadings, essentially really dispose of the case, or dispose of part of the case. And I want to stress to you that one of the reasons why mandamus is inappropriate in this case is not just because of the history of the law that we have that says appeal is really an appropriate remedy, we need to have a reasoned process, we need to see what the evidence was going to be. It's because what's happened is Judge Powell ultimately entered judgment by default on the liability issue and said there will be a trial on damages. Now, suppose there is a trial on damages, and what happens is Toma comes back empty. Doesn't that really moot all the information that's put before you in the request here? Doesn't Toma really have to go through, doesn't there have to be a causal connection between the act complained of, which is the order entered striking the pleading, and the ultimate result, which is some sort of damage to Transamerica? It's
that,
got to come here.
That's a whole other question. I think it's split into the question was this dismissal, if it were solely for failure to show up for a deposition, would that be enough?
You asked me what my personal opinion is, Miss?
Well, no, what the law of the state of Texas is, it should be.
Well, the law in the state of Texas of this says that it depends on whether it's going to be, whether you treat it as an abuse of discretion.
But I mean, certainly it's not. Can it be an abuse?
The answer that I think is clearly is yes. It can be an abuse of discretion, and if you fail to show up for a deposition, I think you have to look at the circumstances in exercising that. But it can be.
Look at the circumstances here, and if he did, what does he have to say to establish that he did?
What does Judge Powell have to say?
Right.
To establish that he looked at the circumstances?
Yes.
Well, I'm not certain that the law, the state of Texas law, requires that he say anything with respect to what he looked at, because there's a presumption that he's aware of what's in his file. He knows that there was discovery that was unanswered. He knows that there were 18 notices of deposition filed 4 days before the close of the discovery process. He knew that depositions were simultaneously set so that the opposing lawyers would be unable to attend both at the same time. He knew that there was a first set of interrogatories for the first time two years late. He knew there was a second request for production of documents 2 years late. He knew that there was a first
2 years
late in the sense that the case began in April of 87 and that wasn't filed. The first set of interrogatories and the second set of interrogatories were filed 2 years after the case was filed, 3 or 4 days before discovery closed, couldn't have been answered within the docket control order. 18 notices of deposition 4 days before, 5 days maybe, before the close of discovery. Witnesses, double set. Witness, one witness going to be deposed at 9 o'clock in the morning somewhere, another witness going to be deposed at 9 o'clock in the morning. We couldn't have gone and covered those depositions. We moved. You know, we, Toma, moved for our protective orders. Remember, there wasn't a motion for a protective order on the May 2nd. There wasn't an act that was done. I mean, this isn't a question of one isolated event. I mean, to think that the judge who's down there controlling his docket, who enters docket control orders, isn't aware of what's going on, you know, is just contrary to what the whole record of this case demonstrates. And I think it's contrary, you know, mandamus, even if you considered it to be appropriate for this case, really, unless I'm wrong in my reading of the law.
I'm a little concerned about the merits of the argument about who was making it to all that, whether or not it was within the period of discovery, or whether or not it's not agreed to, it should have been agreed to, as if it was outside the period. Yeah, less concerned about that than the severity of the sanctions of the trial judge.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the imposition of sanctions might be justified, but the imposition of a sanction such as this might be an abuse of discretion.
Might be. That's right. If, in fact, there's not going to be or if we're going to announce in this case that there is essentially a new standard or some additional considerations, then we're going to look at the severity of the sanction and determine, I mean, you know, in terms of writing your opinion.
Doesn't that have something to do with abuse of discretion?
Well, certainly it does. Certainly. The severity of the abuse of discretion would be depending upon what information was in front of the judge. And I think really the question that you may be driving at, if I understand this, is how specific does the court have to be in detailing whatever its findings are with respect to the action that it takes? In other words, do we want to say to the trial court judges, look, we want you to comply with the findings rule. We want specific reasons to know exactly what took place. We don't care anymore about this presumption that you know about what's in your file. We don't, you know, that's not important to us anymore. What we want to know now is every time you make a decision, or if you make a decision under subsection 5, it's okay if you make them under 1, 2, 3, and 4, but if you're going to make decisions under subsection 5, we consider that to be a different section. I mean, if that's where we're headed in this, then that is not the audible that you have given the trial court so far in the case law.
You're relying on Johnson versus the Fourth Court?
No, not relying on Johnson versus the Fourth Court. The cases that we would rely upon are the Street versus Second Court of Appeals and State versus Walker and Worldwide and Downer. I think the only cases actually in which, the only time this court has acted that I can find in which it has actually granted mandamus is when a privilege has been involved. Either the privilege with respect to the investigatory privilege, which I think was the Butt grocery case, or the product liability problem where you actually can't get the information. You know, we're in the GMC case, they actually couldn't get the defective design in that fuel-fed fire. And their mandamus may have been appropriate, but it wasn't a sanctions case. I mean, Giampulli was not a sanctions case. Here, the effort is, see, you can imagine what, I'll just mention the word floodgate. So I don't say anything more about that. I mean, discovery is where it's at. I mean, that's what's happening. I mean,
we have a... Either now or later, it's a question really. What is left at the trial court? Are there any liability questions left among any parties?
There are liability questions left. No, there are no liability questions left with respect to the principal case, Transamerica versus Toma.
Well,
and Toma...
There are some third-party actions, are there not?
Yeah, there are some third-party actions. But actually, the third-party actions, they fall and disappear as a result of the order.
So there would merely be a trial on damages?
There'd be a trial on damages, right.
If the trial judge abused his discretion in striking the pleadings here, is that sufficient harm for it's called an automatic reversal? I mean, if on appeal the court believes that striking the defense was an abuse of discretion, which has got to be the standard, then does anything else need to be shown?
Damage. Got to go through the trial. If Toma goes to trial and loses, it really boots that whole issue, doesn't it?
How long do you think the trial will take? Someone has suggested a week.
Yeah, either a week or less.